authority to grant a pardon even before any criminal action had been taken against an individual. But obviously, he was in no position to have any opinion on a matter of law. As I saw it at this point, the question clearly before me was, under the circumstances, what course of action should I recommend that would be in the best interest of the country? I told General Haig that I had to have some time to think. Further, that I wanted to talk to James St. Clair. I also said I wanted to talk to my wife before giving any response. I had consistently and firmly held the view previously that in no way whatsoever could I recommend, either publicly or privately, any step by the President that might cause a change in my status as Vice President. As the person who would become President if a vacancy occurred for any reason in that office, a Vice President, I believe, should endeavor not to do or say anything which might affect his President's tenure in office. Therefore, I certainly was not even ready under these new circumstances to make any recommendations about resignation without having adequate time to consider further what I should properly do. Shortly after 8 o'clock the next morning, James St. Clair came to my office. Although he did not spell out in detail the new evidence, there was no question in my mind that he considered these revelations to be so damaging that impeachment in the House was a certainty and conviction in the Senate a high probability. When I asked Mr. St. Clair if he knew of any other new and damaging evidence beside that on the June 23, 1972 tape, he said no. When I pointed out to him the various options mentioned to me by General Haig, he told me he had not been the source of any opinion about presidential pardon power. After thought on the matter, I was determined not to make any recommendations to President Nixon on his resignation. I had not given any advice or recommendations in my conversations with his aides. But I also did not want anyone who might talk to the President to suggest that I had some intention to do so. For that reason, Mr. Chairman, I decided I should call General Haig the afternoon of August 2nd. I did make the call late that afternoon and told him I wanted him to understand that I had no intention of recommending what President Nixon should do about resigning or not resigning, and that nothing we had talked about the previous afternoon should be given any consideration in whatever decision the President might make. General Haig told me he was in full agreement with this position. My travel schedule called for me to make appearances in Mississippi and Louisiana over Saturday, Sunday, and part of Monday, August 3, 4, and 5. In the previous 8 months, I had repeatedly stated my opinion that the President would not be found guilty of any impeachable offense. Any change from my stated views, or even refusal to comment further, I feared, would lead in the press to conclusions that I now wanted to see the President resign to avoid an impeachment vote in the House and probable conviction in the Senate. For that reason, I remained firm in my answers to press questions during that trip and repeated my belief in the President's innocence of an impeachable offense. Not until I returned to Washington did I learn that President Nixon was to release the new evidence late on Monday, August 5, 1974. At about the same time, I was notified that the President had called a cabinet meeting for Tuesday morning, August 6, 1974. At that meeting in the Cabinet room, I announced that I was making no recommendations to the President as to what he should do in light of the new evidence. I made no recommendations to him either at that meeting or at any time after that. In summary, Mr. Chairman, I assure you that there was never at any time any agreement whatsoever concerning a pardon to Mr. Nixon if he were to resign and I were to become president. Mr. Chairman, turning now to House Resolution 1367. The first question of House Resolution 1367 asks whether I or my representative had specific knowledge of any formal criminal charges pending against Richard M. Nixon. The answer is no. I had known, of course, Mr. Chairman, that the grand jury investigating the Watergate break-in and cover-up had wanted to name President Nixon as an unindicted co-conspirator in the cover-up. Also, I knew that an extensive report had been prepared by the Watergate Special Prosecution Force for the grand jury and had been sent to the House Committee on Judiciary, where I believe it served the staff and the members of the committee in the development of its report on the proposed articles of impeachment. Beyond what was disclosed in the publications of the Judiciary Committee on the subject and additional evidence released by President Nixon on August 5, 1974, I saw on or shortly after September 4th a copy of a memorandum prepared for Special Prosecutor Jaworski by the Deputy Special Prosecutor, Henry Ruth. A copy of this memorandum has been furnished by Mr. Jaworski to my counsel and was later made public during a press briefing at the White House on September 10, 1974. I have supplied the subcommittee with a copy of this memorandum. The memorandum lists matters still under investigation, which, and I quote, may prove to have some direct connection to activities in which Mr. Nixon is personally involved, end quote. The Watergate cover-up is not included in this list, and the alleged cover-up is mentioned only as being the subject of a separate memorandum not furnished to me. Of those matters which are listed in the memorandum, it is stated that none of them at the moment rises to the level of our ability to prove even a probable criminal violation by Mr. Nixon. This is all the information I had which related even to the possibility of formal criminal charges involving the former president while he had been in office. The second question in the resolution asks whether Alexander Haig referred to or discussed a pardon with Richard Nixon or his representatives at any time during the week of August 4, 1974, or any subsequent time. My answer to that question is, not to my knowledge. If any such discussions did occur, they could not have been a factor in my decision to grant the pardon when I did, because I was not aware of them. Question 3 and 4 of House Resolution 1367 deal with the first and all subsequent references to or discussions of a pardon for Richard M. Nixon with him or any of his representatives or aides. I have already described at length what discussions took place on August 1 and 2, 1974, and how these discussions brought no recommendations or commitments whatsoever on my part. These were the only discussions related to questions 3 and 4 before I became president. But question 4 relates also to subsequent discussions. At no time after I became president on August 9, 1974, was the subject of a pardon for Richard M. Nixon raised by the former president or by anyone representing him. Also, no one on my staff brought up the subject until the day before my first press conference on August 28, 1974. At that time, I was advised that questions on the subject might be raised by media reporters at the press conference. As the press conference proceeded, the first question asked involved the subject, as did other later questions. In my answers to those questions, I took a position that while I was the final authority on this matter, I expected to make no commitment one way or the other, depending on what the special prosecutor and courts would do. However, I also stated that I believed the general view of the American people was to spare the former president from a criminal trial. Shortly afterwards, I became greatly concerned that if Mr. Nixon's prosecution and trial were prolonged, the passions generated over a long period of time would seriously disrupt the healing of our country from the wounds of the past. I could see that the new administration could not be effective if it had to operate in the atmosphere of having a former president under prosecution and criminal trial. Each step along the way, I was deeply concerned, would become a public spectacle and the topic of wide public debate and controversy. As I have before stated publicly, these concerns led me to ask from my own legal counsel what my full right of pardon was under the Constitution in this situation, and from the special prosecutor what criminal actions, if any, were likely to be brought against the former president, how long his prosecution and trial would take. As soon as I had been given this information, Mr. Chairman, I authorized my counsel, Philip Buchan, to tell Herbert J. Miller, as attorney for Richard M. Nixon, of my pending decision to grant a pardon for the former president. I was advised that the disclosure was made on September 4, 1974, when Mr. Buchan, accompanied by Benton Becker, met with Mr. Miller. Mr. Becker had been asked, with my concurrence, to take on a temporary special assignment to assist Mr. Buchan at a time when no one else of my selection had yet been appointed to the legal staff of the White House. The fourth question, Mr. Chairman, in the resolution also asks about negotiations with Mr. Nixon or his representatives on the subject of a pardon for the former president. The pardon under consideration was not, so far as I was concerned, a matter of negotiation. I realized that unless Mr. Nixon actually accepted the pardon I was preparing to grant, it probably would not be effective. So I certainly had no intention to proceed without knowing if it would be accepted. Otherwise, I put no conditions on my granting of a pardon which required any negotiations. Although negotiations had been started earlier and were conducted through September 6 concerning White House records of the prior administration, I did not make any agreement on that subject a condition of the pardon. The circumstances leading to an initial agreement on presidential records are not covered by the resolutions before this subcommittee. Therefore, I have mentioned discussions on that subject with Mr. Nixon's attorney only to show that they were related in time to the pardon discussions, but were not a basis for my decision to grant a pardon to the former president. The fifth, sixth and seventh questions of House Resolution 1367 ask whether I consulted with certain persons before making my pardon decision. I did not consult at all with Attorney General Saxby on the subject of a pardon for Mr. Nixon. My only conversation on the subject with Vice Presidential nominee Nelson Rockefeller was to report to him on September 6, 1974, that I was planning to grant the pardon. Special Prosecutor Jaworski was contacted on my instructions by my counsel, Philip Buchan. One purpose of their discussions was to seek the information I wanted on what possible criminal charges might be brought against Mr. Nixon. The result of that inquiry was a copy of the memorandum I have already referred to and have furnished to this subcommittee. The only other purpose was to find out the opinion of the special prosecutor as to how long a delay would follow in the event of Mr. Nixon's indictment before a trial could be started and concluded. At a White House press briefing on September 8, 1974, the principal portions of Mr. Jaworski's opinion were made public. In this opinion, Mr. Jaworski wrote that selection of a jury for the trial of the former president, if he were indicted, would require a delay, and I quote, of a period from 9 months to a year, and perhaps even longer, end quote. On the question of how long it would take to conduct such a trial, he noted that the complexities of the jury selection made it difficult to estimate the time. Copy of the full text of his opinion, dated September 4, 1974, I have now furnished to this subcommittee. I did consult with my counsel, Philip Buchan, with Benton Becker, and with my counselor, John Marsh, who is also an attorney. Outside of these men serving at the time on my immediate staff, I consulted with no other attorneys or professors of law for facts or legal authorities bearing on my decision to grant a pardon to the former president. Questions 8 and 9 of House Resolution 1367 deal with the circumstances of any statement requested or received from Mr. Nixon. I asked for no confession or statement of guilt, only a statement in acceptance of the pardon when it was granted. No language was suggested or requested by anyone acting for me, to my knowledge. My counsel advised me that he had told the attorney for Mr. Nixon that he believed the statement should be one, expressing contrition, and in this respect, I was told Mr. Miller concurred. Before I announced the pardon, I saw a preliminary draft of a proposed statement from Mr. Nixon, but I did not regard the language of the statement as subsequently issued to be subject to approval by me or my representatives. The 10th question, Mr. Chairman, covers any report to me on Mr. Nixon's health by a physician or psychiatrist which led to my pardon decision. I received no such report. Whatever information was generally known to me at the time of my pardon decision was based on my own observations of his condition at the time he resigned as president, and observations reported to me after that from others who had later seen or talked with him. No such reports were by people qualified to evaluate medically the condition of Mr. Nixon's health, and so they were not a controlling factor in my decision. However, I believed and still believe that prosecution and trial of the former president would have proved a serious threat to his health, as I stated in my message on September 8, 1974. House Resolution 1370 is the other resolution of inquiry before this subcommittee. It presents no questions, but asks for the full and complete facts upon which was based my decision to grant a pardon to Richard M. Nixon. I know of no such facts that are not covered by my answers to the question in House Resolution 1367. Also, subparagraphs 1 and 4, there were no representations made by me or for me, and none by Mr. Nixon or for him, on which my pardon decision was based. Subparagraph 2, the health issue is dealt with by me in answer to questions 10 of the previous resolution. Subparagraph 3, information available to me about possible offenses in which Mr. Nixon might have been involved is covered in my answer to the first questions of the earlier resolution. In addition, in an unnumbered paragraph at the end of House Resolution 1370 seeks information on possible pardons for Watergate-related offenses which others may have committed. I have decided that all persons requesting consideration of pardon requests should submit them through the Department of Justice. Only when I receive information on any request duly filed and considered first by the pardon attorney at the Department of Justice would I consider the matter. As yet, no such information has been received, and if it does, I will act or decline to act according to the particular circumstances presented, and not on the basis of the unique circumstances as I saw them of former President Nixon. Mr. Chairman, by these responses to the resolutions of inquiry, I believe I have fully and fairly presented the facts and the circumstances preceding my pardon of former President Nixon. In this way, I hope I have contributed to a much better understanding by the American people of the action I took to grant the pardon when I did. For having afforded me this opportunity, I do express my appreciation to you, Mr. Chairman, and to Mr. Smith, the other members of the subcommittee, and also to Chairman Rodino of the Committee on Judiciary, to Mr. Hutchinson, the ranking minority member of the full committee, and to other distinguished members of the full committee who are present. In closing, Mr. Chairman, I would like to reemphasize that I acted solely for the reasons I stated in my proclamation of September 8, 1974, and my accompanying message, and that I acted out of my concern to serve the best interests of my country. As I stated then, Mr. Chairman, and I quote, my concern is the immediate future of this great country. My conscience tells me it is my duty not merely to proclaim domestic tranquility, but to use every means that I have to ensure it, end quote. Mr. Chairman, I thank you and the committee members for the opportunity to make these views known.
Mr. President, on behalf of the subcommittee, we express our appreciation to your appearance here and bringing facts that will be helpful to the American people and the Congress. And there will be some who will find the answers fully satisfactory and forthright, and there will be others who will not. But I would hope that all would appreciate your openness and willingness to come before the American public and the Congress to discuss this important matter. The gentleman from Wisconsin, Mr. Kastenmeier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, would like to join my colleagues in welcoming the President. I don't believe any of us could have anticipated a year ago when the President then appeared as a nominee under the 25th Amendment for Vice President, that he would once again appear before this committee as President of the United States. And I would only comment, no matter how well motivated the desire to put Watergate behind us, I can only acknowledge today that several key issues in the news this morning, the President's appearance before this committee, the trial downtown, the Watergate trial itself, and even the nomination of Mr. Rockefeller to be the Vice President, occasioned by a vacancy due to Watergate, all of these still command the attention of the American people, and I guess we'll just have to be patient. Mr. President, you indicated that you want to bear Mr. Nixon a criminal trial. Did you specifically have any other end in view in terms of protecting Mr. Nixon in terms of a pardon? That is to say, whatever a pardon would spare the president. Other than a criminal trial, were there any other adversities which a pardon would help Mr. Nixon with as you saw it?
As I indicated in the proclamation that I issued and as I indicated in